Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest high-level officials' passage through the revolving door as the former Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, trades in public service for private gain, joining the Wall Street private equity giant Warburg Pincus. William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, joins us to discuss the unsurprising move from the public to the private sector by the man who made sure that Wall Street was made whole with taxpayer money after they almost destroyed the economy. Then we'll examine the fate of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement and the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TAFTA, that is stalled because of European outrage over NSA spying, much of which has been directed at the European partners in the agreement to find out what their negotiating positions are. The former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce, Clyde Prestowitz, joins us to discuss pushback in Congress and from the Europeans, as well as his recent article at Foreign Policy, The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Decline of America. Then finally, we will discuss the uncertain fate of the Affordable Care Act following a vote in the House of 261-157 to gut Obamacare that passed with the help of 39 Democratic lawmakers. Dr. Susan Wood, a professor of health policy and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services, joins us to discuss how political considerations overwhelm technical needs in the launching of healthcare.gov and what can be done to put Obamacare back on the rails. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Black.
Thank you.
And as I mentioned in the opening, Bill, this is not exactly surprising the latest high-level officials' passage through the revolving door where Tim Geithner is trading in his public service for private gain, joining the private Wall Street private equity giant Warburg Pincus. Managing director of Warburg Pincus early in Tim Geithner's career. So has he had a relationship with him going back to when he was in charge of the New York Fed?
I think he must have. It's pretty much impossible to have that position without having close relationships with all the heavy hitters, and Warburg Pincus was a very heavy hitter. And as you said, as soon as Geithner started, he got a lot of criticism, of course, and so the former managing director, Warburg Pincus, rushed into the media to defend him repeatedly, and I did a series of columns saying that, if this is the defense of Geithner, the defense has actually convicted him.
And this was at the time that he got the job, right, the Secretary of Treasury job?
Yes. And, of course, even then, people were tending to forget all of these disastrous years as head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where he was supposed to regulate most of the largest bank holding companies in America, and did a particularly poor job. So there was an overall regulatory failure, but the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission singled out the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for particular scorn. So among the worst of the worst, that was Geithner. So he was one of the key people that brought the crisis, and he was famously he was asked by the House about his experience as a regulator, and he said, "I have to stop you right there. I was never a regulator." And of course, that's true, but you're not supposed to admit it.
But isn't that what the Federal Reserve Bank Board is about, regulating the economy? I mean, regulating the banks, I should say.
Supposed to be, and supervision and examination is delegated within the Federal Home Loan Bank system overwhelmingly to the regional feds, and within the regional Feds, the one that is more equal than others by far is the New York Fed. So, yes, his principal task was really to be regulating, and it was a task that he didn't do at all. And so, you know, it was insane that Obama promoted him for his massive failure.
So this is this an extraordinary example of the Peter principle, people failing upwards?
Yeah, I mean, he was, except that he keeps failing upwards. The Peter principle generally said that you rose to your level of incompetence and then you couldn't get more promotions. But you need a Geithner exception to that, where you keep getting promoted despite failing at higher and higher posts. Geithner had failed before in Treasury days and in, you know, IMF World Bankish type phase in dealing with financial crises, although he claims to have been a great success in dealing with them.
Again, I'm speaking with William Black, who's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And you're also at the University of Minnesota, right?
Yes. My spouse just took a position up here at the law school, so I'll have some as yet not fully defined capacity at the University of Minnesota.
All right, well,
as well.
Already,
one of my prior jobs, I should mention as well, because it's critical to Geithner. I was also the senior vice president and general counsel of the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco. And the savings and loan regulation was done the same way as banking regulation is still done today. In other words, the regional banks are where the examiners and supervisors were overwhelmingly employed. And the regional banks, in the savings and loan case and in the Fed case, are owned by the banks they're supposed to regulate. And they pick most of the boards of directors. So this is an insane conflict of interest. Congress recognized this in 1989 and eliminated it in the savings and loan context in 1989 in the FERIA legislation. But they failed to do the same thing in the Federal Reserve. So we have this complete conflict of interest that has continued to this day. And the Geithners of the world, you know, they call it public service. But especially when you're the New York Fed, you're not there to serve the public. You're there to serve the biggest banks in the world.
So Tim Geithner's new job is president of the Wall Street-based leverage buyout firm Warburg Pincus. And these private equity firms pool money from investors to buy companies within about 5 to 6 years. Then they sell them and return the funds with a profit of about after about 10 years. And they use debt to finance these deals and amplify their returns. And they typically charge an annual management fee of 1.5% to 2% on the funds. And they keep 20% of the profits from investments as carried interest. And carried interest, as you well know, is treated as capital gains and taxed as at 15%, whereas mere mortals are, what are we at now, about 37% or something?
Yeah, so this is Mitt Romney, basically. People got to, your listeners got to know about this in the context of Mitt Romney. Some of them may have known before. But this is an incredibly wealthy world, on a par, basically, with the most lucrative hedge funds. And so this is an enormous payoff. Now, remember, Geithner was not subject to federal pay caps when he was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So he has already been made a wealthy man in that supposed public service that really isn't. And remember, he's also the guy that cheated on his taxes when he was with the you know, the World Bank or IMF, although he had to eventually give that money back to become Secretary of the Treasury. And remember also that Geithner is not somebody from economics or finance. So he is not someone who is technically skilled. So the only reason to put him as head, he, of course, can't really be head. He's just a face person to get you in the door, and in particular, to get sovereign wealth funds, you know, things like the Kuwaiti Investment Office and the Saudis, to invest more money with Warburg Pincus. So he's a glad hander and a handshaker that's going to be making many millions of dollars a year, probably.
And Warburg Pincus, that's a 47-year-old private equity firm with about $35 billion in assets. But what distinguishes it from its rivals like Blackstone and Kohlberg Kravis Roberts is that it's privately held. So that, of course, probably is very attractive to the Saudis and others, right? It's not a public company.
That's correct. And it's also, in at least recent years, been much more tied to the Democratic Party.
In what sense is it tied to the two guys that run it are give money to the Democratic Party?
So, for example, the former managing partner that I was debating was with the Roosevelt Institute and the New Deal 2.0.
What about this guy Chip Kay and Joe Landy that they run? They've been running the firm since 2000. Do they back the Democrats out of ideology, or they just back whoever the winner is? I thought that's how wealthy people operated. They weren't didn't operate out of ideology, but out of pragmatism.
It's a mixture. The Koch brothers certainly operate out of ideology pretty much entirely. And there are some Democratic supporters that do that as well. But if you're asking, this was more Democratic leadership type council type viewpoints. So the managing director that I was debating was someone who was very, very friendly, as you would expect, to big finance and believed that the Democratic Party should be allied with big finance and comes out of the Rubin wing of the party.
So what's your sense then of where we stand now in terms of this whole episode with 2008? I think you may have missed the opening, my opening introduction, but, you know, this is a we're talking about Tim Geithner here. He's a man who's making this unsurprising move from the public to the private sector. And Geithner made sure that Wall Street was made whole with taxpayer money after they almost destroyed the economy. Now we hear from Elizabeth Warren and others that they're even too bigger to fail than they were before. Will this just continue on, this inexorable kind of juggernaut, the financialization of the economy, more and more of our economy being dominated by Wall Street and our politics being owned by Wall Street?
Until they cause the next crisis, and then the issue is going to be whether there will be enough political resolve to actually break them up and shrink them to the point that they're no longer systemically dangerous.
And
which is what people like me have been urging for years. But it does, you know, there's the Obama administration not only decided not to get rid of the systemically dangerous institutions, it decided that it would give special bailouts. In some cases, Geithner used secret bailouts through AIG as a conduit to bail out favored banks, including many foreign banks, by the way. So I think you'll see that many people will be very happy to take phone calls from Timothy Geithner out there in the world because, you know, big finance understands that the world works on a reciprocal basis and only klutzes have to run afoul of bribery laws. Right? If you do it in this kind of revolving door fashion, there's no crime under the way the law is interpreted, and you can be made vastly more wealthy than by taking a bribe and such. So those kind of old-fashioned bribes in the U.S. context are not entirely a thing of the past, but largely a thing of the past. You know, you're dealing with sort of C-minus bribers when they do it in klutzy ways.
Well, I guess none of this is surprising because isn't the joke that Goldman Sachs is referred to as Government Sachs, because you had former Secretary of Treasury Robert Rubin going from Goldman Sachs to Secretary of Treasury and back to Goldman Sachs. You had Hank Paulson going from Wall Street to the George W. Bush administration's Secretary of Treasury and then going back to Goldman Sachs. I mean,
yes, that's exactly what it's called in the trade and in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, the then president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City openly, to a group of about 20 of us at a dinner, said that in the modern era, we stage an auction for who will be the Treasury Secretary. And of late, Goldman Sachs has been dominating those auctions. And that's a pretty amazing thing for a conservative Republican to be saying.
Well, but if you use
the Obama administration.
Sure, but just to follow through on your analogy, or his analogy, William Black, if you're doing an auction, who gets the money?
Oh, well, the political official gets the money, and the political parties more broadly get the money.
Right. So if it were an art auction, the political official is the painting, and the company is what? They're the ones that end up with it? Or?
Oh, well, Goldman Sachs is buying the painting, and right. It installs – I don't think the metaphor works quite that way, but
right.
Goldman Sachs buys the right to appoint the Treasury Secretary of its liking,
uh-huh.
who is frequently one of their alumni.
I see.
Whether or not he's directly one of their alumni, he's someone that will do the right thing for big finance. Right, but
right.
Goldman Sachs means that not only will that person that they pick for Treasury Secretary do stuff for big finance, it will make particularly sure that Goldman Sachs does well.
I see, and essentially the others are just competing to have their guy in the same job, the other
correct.
Wall Street giants. So
yeah.
I get the analogy here. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Bill Black. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the fate of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TAFTA.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. I never give you my number.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Clyde Prestowitz, who's the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He is the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. And his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. His latest article at Foreign Policy is The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Decline of American Hegemony. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clyde Prestowitz.
Nice to be with you.
And it does seem that both the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TAFTA, are both in trouble for somewhat different reasons. Trans-Pacific Partnership, of course, there was a leak from WikiLeaks last week that led to a lot of outrage on Capitol Hill over the fast-track provision, and the Congress wants to assert itself in that regard. Obviously, they don't like being cut out of the loop. And then you've got the NSA, outrage over the NSA spying on the Europeans. So let's start with the TPP. Why do you say the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you associate that with the decline of American hegemony?
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership concept is really not so much an economic concept as is a geopolitical one. So, in other words, the U.S., if it does this TPP, economically, the U.S. gets little, if anything, probably negative out of the deal. It's supposed to make our Asian friends feel more comfortable, like we're more committed to them, and it's part of our effort to shape and shift and respond to China. And in my view, the two problems with it are, one, that economically it continues a global economic structure that more or less forces the United States to have a trade deficit and continues to drain jobs out of the U.S. But at the same time, it doesn't effectively deal with our relationship with China. So I see it as kind of a double negative.
Even though it appears to be ganging up on China, because it's everybody in the Pacific and in Southeast Asia except China.
Well, of course, everybody in the U.S. and the other countries that are negotiating all swear that it's not aimed at China. But, you know, China has its own comprehensive economic, regional economic project. And that also is a free trade agreement that the Chinese are leading, and almost everybody is in that deal except us. You know, so, you know, in the TPP, you have countries like Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, Japan, and these guys are also negotiating a similar deal with China. So, you know, in my view, it just is not a very effective response.
So, when you say that I mean, this is just a part of the, it's more political or geopolitical in the sense that it's a part of the Obama administration's so-called pivot to Asia. What is the likelihood of the Congress reaching a point where they could block it? I mean,
well, that's a really good question. There are two things going on. One is this deal's being negotiated, and the administration is also asking the Congress for so-called fast-track authority. So fast-track means that once a deal is done, it's presented to the Congress, and the Congress may vote up or down, but with no amendments. So what the administration is hoping is that they can successfully complete a TPP deal, successfully get the Congress to authorize fast-track, present the deal to the Congress, get an upvote, and then it would become a treaty and would become law. The problems that they have are, one, it's not at all clear that they can actually do the deal. WikiLeaks has not only revealed one of the chapters of the draft deal, but that chapter also revealed a lot of discord among the negotiating countries. So, you know, whether or not they can actually do this deal is still a question mark. But secondly, and in a way more importantly, the request for fast track is in big trouble. It was in trouble before the WikiLeaks leak. Administrations since Nixon have constantly asked for fast track authority to deal with trade negotiations. So the Tokyo round of the WTO, the Uruguay round, NAFTA, all of these deals were done under fast-track authority. But every time that an administration goes to Congress for fast-track, it has gotten the fast-track authority, but by a smaller and smaller majority. And last week, 150 congressmen wrote a letter to the White House saying that they would not support fast-track unless the administration revealed more to them about the state of negotiations. So that's almost half of the House of Representatives. And in light of the WikiLeaks leak, it's very questionable in my mind whether they can get fast-track. If they don't get fast-track, then I think the TPP will not be able to pass the Congress, even if they could negotiate the deal, which is not at all clear.
And they're starting to negotiate again, right, in Utah.
That's right. That's the next round. They're trying desperately to get this deal done by the end of the year, but the shutdown of the government and the fact that there remains a lot of dissatisfaction among the negotiating partners is making it look more and more difficult to get this deal, you know, even to get a draft deal done by the end of the year.
And again, I'm speaking with Clyde Prestowitz, former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, and his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. His latest article at Foreign Policy is The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Decline of American hegemony. Let's turn to the other big trade pact. It's not getting the same amount of attention, but I think it's actually a bigger deal. That's the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TAFTA. I believe it's being stalled now because of European outrage over the National Security Agency spying, which I understand most of the spying of the NSA has been directed at the European partners to find out what their negotiating positions are.
Yeah, it's a shame that TAFTA, or the official name TTIP, Trade, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Project, is a big deal, potentially is a really big deal, and potentially could add 3 or 4% to U.S. GDP. It's mostly about regulations. We already have, between the EU and the U.S., very low tariffs. Very few formal trade barriers, but we have lots of regulatory differences. Just to mention one, take headlights on cars. The Europeans have a regulation on the way headlights are supposed to be done, and we have a regulation on the way headlights are supposed to be done. And they're both sets of regulations are adopted for safety reasons, but they're different. So if you're a U.S. producer and you're producing a car in the U.S., you want to ship it to Europe, well, you got to change the headlight. There's just lots of stuff like that, could be unified, modified, and it would be a big deal. But there are two problems. One is these regulatory things are very hard to negotiate. All those regulations are the result internally of political forces, and now you have to change all the political forces on both sides in order to change the regulations. But then on top of that, the NSA decided to listen to Angela Merkel's telephone calls, even her cell phone calls, and as you say, trying to find out what the European negotiating agenda was or what the Europeans were thinking about their negotiating agenda. Apparently, Chancellor Merkel is unhappy, and the rest of the Europeans are very unhappy, too. So this has become a big question mark.
Well, Clyde Prestowitz, I spoke the other day to Joe Biden's former economic advisor, who had an article in the New York Times on
Jared Bernstein.
Jared Bernstein, right, talking about how we're going after the wrong deficit. The obsession with the skies falling over the budget deficit is misplaced, since it's going down in any case. But the real issue has always been the trade deficit. And if you dealt with the trade deficit, you'd improve the economy, which in turn would improve the budget deficit. So it's like a no-brainer, but why no focus on it?
Well, it is a no-brainer. It's been a no-brainer, in my view, for 30 years. I was really delighted to see Jared's op-ed in the New York Times, because that op-ed that he wrote does not represent the conventional wisdom of most American economists, and definitely does not represent the thinking of Joe Biden and the White House. So the fact that Jared wrote it, I thought was very revealing, and I hope it'll get a lot more attention. It should be a no-brainer. We run a trade deficit. That means that we're buying more than we're selling. That means that we are creating fewer jobs here than we should, than we could and should be. And the irony is other countries, the Europeans, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, the Singaporeans, are all pursuing job creation strategies based on running trade surpluses with the U.S. So reversing that dynamic would be very, very good for us, but it has become associated in policy circles with economic views that are thought to be industrial policy and are thought to be protectionist, and so we just don't do it.
You mean the ghost of Smoot-Hawley?
The ghost of Smoot-Hawley, exactly, is still still alive and kicking.
So tell us more, though. I mean, I've been talked to a bunch of people in Silicon Valley and other people involved in internet entrepreneurs and startups, etc. And obviously, this healthcare.gov is an example of how not to do the internet. But that's one nightmare the President Obama has. And the other one, his other big pivot to Asia, which we're talking about, you're suggesting it'd be a good thing if the TPP went down, which it may do. But in terms of collateral damage from the National Security Agency, my understanding is that it's huge and growing in the business world, and that the outrage over the NSA tapping into the big clouds, data clouds that Microsoft and Google have, and there's even talk, I understand, that we could have a chip war because the Chinese don't trust American chips anymore. They think they've got a backdoor to the NSA. Yeah. And conversely, we don't trust the Chinese chips because they may have a backdoor to their equivalent of the NSA. Is this where we're heading?
It's where we are. It's exactly where we are. The large Chinese telecom company called Huawei, H-U-A-W-E-I, has been effectively prevented from selling any significant amount of equipment in the U.S., because U.S. security agencies do not trust that the equipment won't have bugs in it. And now the NSA has given the Chinese the perfect excuse for taking the same approach to U.S. equipment. So, yeah, it's a huge issue. And, I mean, obviously, if you're in the big data business like Google or Amazon, companies like that, this has to be a huge concern.
So what explains, Clyde Brestowitz, that Intel recently opened a new plant in China to make Pentium chips? And you know, most of that work is done through automation and robots. So that I don't see the component of cheap labor in this. What was the reason?
No, it's not. It has nothing to do with cheap labor. There's virtually no labor in a Pentium chip. It's all capital and technology. And there are several considerations, I would say. One is that Intel wants to be closer to its customers in China to better serve them. Second is it wants to tap into growing pool of Chinese technical talent. But I would say there are two really major factors. One of them was that Intel was just under a lot of pressure. Every time an Intel executive would go to China, you know, all she or he would hear from Chinese authorities all the way from the president of China down to the guy who sweeps the floor was, when are you going to put a factory in China? Don't you know that you have to maintain a high image in China? Demonstrate your commitment to China. So a lot of continual, that kind of moral pressure, let's say. But secondly, the Chinese made it very attractive through financial investment incentives. So, you know, they provide free land for the factory and no taxes for a certain number of years. And maybe utilities and other costs at reduced prices. So, you know, in effect, they provide a they cut the amount of investment required. So if the factory costs $5 or $6 billion to build, in effect, the Chinese government, in one way or another, puts in $2 or $3 billion, and that kind of reduction in investment costs makes it makes the return on investment look very good.
So it sounds like the
Just to quantify that, Paul Ottolini, the previous chief executive of Intel, has said that Intel saves about $1 billion a year on that factory, and that saving largely comes from these kinds of investment subsidies.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Clyde Prestowitz, we talked about the NSA and the collateral damage from NSA spying, particularly with the possibility that China is not going to accept any more U.S. chips because they think that there's a backdoor to the NSA and that we are already blocking Chinese goods coming in because of our fears of them being compromised. So. On the other hand, I hear that the Chinese consumers more and more distrust their own home brands. For example, there's a black market in baby formula because nobody trusts the baby formula in China, and then nobody trusts the dog food after they poison a bunch of dogs, etc. So this would indicate to me that the United States has a huge opportunity there if they could ever get into that market because the domestic brands are suffering, whereas the U.S. brands...
Yeah, no, I think there are those kinds of opportunities in China, and a lot of American companies are doing very well in their business in China. But when you go into China, you have to go in with your eyes open and recognize that it's the Wild West, and the rules are a little bit different. And sometimes that helps you because, you know, the rules are so bad that they poison their own dogs or their own babies. And so that's an opening for you to actually give them safe dog food or baby food. But sometimes the rules are set to put you at a disadvantage. And so, for example, you, in order to be allowed to do business in China, you have to transfer your technology to China or go into business in a way that allows one of your competitors to imitate what you're doing. So, you know, there's opportunity, but there's also a lot of risk and danger.
Well, Clyde Prestowitz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Clyde Prestowitz, who's the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books, Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. And his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. His latest article at Foreign Policy is The Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Decline of American Hegemony. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about how the political considerations overwhelm technical needs in the launching of healthcare.gov and what can be done to put Obamacare back on the rails. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Wood.
Oh, glad to be there. Thank you.
And the House passed essentially a bill that guts Obamacare by 261 to 157 with the help of 39 Democratic lawmakers. And that obviously, would at the end of the day invite a presidential veto. So it's probably more symbolic than it is substantive. But nevertheless, I don't think there's much doubt, surely, that the Affordable Care Act is in trouble. Let's get into the issues of how political considerations overwhelm technical needs in the launching of healthcare.gov, and then we'll get into how it could be put back on the rails. But let's start with that, because there was that article, in fact, that you recommended to me, Susan, from the Washington Post. It does a pretty good forensic examination of how things happened the way they did. Is that it in a nutshell, that political considerations overwhelm technical needs?
Well, I think headlines are often sort of trying to grab the sort of short, punchy story of it. But I think it just, with the short statement I would make about it is that there are a lot of different factors that came into play. Some of them may well have been political in terms of timing of decision making, but on the whole, it can't be easily pointed at one thing or another. But unfortunately, we had this combination of issues ranging from technical all the way through to political that led us to where we are today, which is unfortunately a rollout of a program, of a website and a IT system that did not work, and then the complicated by the factors of states that don't want to do their own and the financing and the contracting process and so forth, that we are at a situation where we really need to very quickly, and the administration needs to very quickly not just fix this, but have something that's workable in a timely fashion so that we can actually benefit from all the good things that actually are in the Affordable Care Act.
So is this a case, though? We were just talking about trade deals with China, and the difference between the Chinese government, apart from the fact that it's a totalitarian system or an authoritarian system, whatever way you want to characterize it. But so many of the Chinese leaders are engineers. This was pointed out to me by a listener recently. So many of their top leaders are engineers, where almost all of our congressmen, senators, and people in the White House are lawyers. Do we just have too many lawyers?
Oh, I'd hate to get into that debate. As a scientist, we always are competing with all the lawyers in town. But it is true that I think when we are trying to create this piece of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, we have to remember this is just part of it, the part that is affecting mainly those people who do not have any insurance or those that who have individual plans and who should be able to get better insurance for a better deal through the exchange. And that's the piece. It's a significant piece, but it's not everybody by any stretch of imagination. But taking this on to create a technical, a piece of technology that is very complicated because of its crossing between information about income and access and insurance companies and benefits, that doing that is not trivial and requires a lot of technical expertise as well as expertise in areas like insurance benefits and government regulations. And it appeared that, and I was not inside the government, this, so I'm merely speculating, but that the focus on the technical piece of it wasn't carried out and in a way that was successful. And so we need, because people there who were experts in perhaps all the other complex aspects of this were there, but the focus did not also extend to making sure the technical side worked.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health and a professor for health policy and of environmental and occupational health and executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. But it seems to me what's happening here, Dr. Susan Wood, is that these problems with the launching of healthcare.gov and the Affordable Care Act have absolutely consumed the political debate. They consumed the headlines.
Yeah.
And people have forgotten that we have a broken health system. Isn't that really where we're eyes off the ball here? They're saying we should go back. That's what the Republicans in the House are saying. Let's go back to what we had before, that, you know, as if that worked, for God's sake.
Exactly. I mean, we have not been able to focus on either the benefits that are already in place. I mean, and what we would have liked to have seen is that people, as we live through the transition of this part, people would look back and say, right, I didn't have to change. I still have my good employer-based insurance, but gosh, now I don't have to pay copays for my preventive services, so I'm more likely to get that mammogram, or I'm more likely to get that colonoscopy. And gosh, for young women, now my contraception doesn't have those burdensome copays or deductibles, so I can now make decisions about my family life. Or people would say, oh gosh, my kid is able to stay on my insurance since they're 26. Isn't that great? And I have a brother who's now able to get health insurance where he couldn't get it before, or a nephew or a niece or a grandkid or a cousin or my neighbor around the corner. And we would say, wow, that was really great. This, you know, I know people who got insurance. I myself have seen my benefits get better, and it's a little more affordable. Isn't that good? But instead, we're having this crisis of confidence. Hopefully it will pass as this starts to work. But we are focused on just this fact that it's difficult, although getting easier, to sign up for health insurance for those who don't have it and for those who have inadequate individual plans. And so what should have been a smooth transition and people slowly recognizing the benefits, we're now focused on this real problem, but it's not the be-all and end-all of problems. And we really should still be able to recognize the overall benefits of the Affordable Care Act. And so, assuming we get past this period of transition, ultimately we will recognize that benefit.
So what will it take then to get this negativity off the headlines and the hyperbole about how disastrous it is and everybody's piling on? The Democrats are clearly nervous. The Republicans are gleeful. Former President Bill Clinton weighed in the other day.
Right.
Maybe he's thinking about his wife's run in 2016. The Democrats certainly don't want this is an albatross. This was what they thought they had was a winner here, right?
Exactly, and it still can be, and I still hope that it is, because, I mean, not for the political point of view, but because of the opportunity to actually get people affordable health insurance coverage and to get people actually access to better health care. And I think we have to live through this. This transition has not been nearly what it should have been, and in fact it's been politically, you know, a big blow up, and I just still hope, and I don't know because I'm not inside, that indeed by the end of November, online signing up for health insurance will become smooth, and that we also then roll out what was originally planned for October was a massive public education and outreach from nonprofit organizations, from health organizations, from people who work with the uninsured, with the homeless, but also with you know, young people, and with, you know, to really reach out and say, come on, and we can help you sign up. And we're not going to leave it to people sitting in their living rooms, you know, on their laptop computers, but rather to help people who don't have insurance, have never had insurance, who really need insurance, to help them sign up. These are the navigators and the assisters, the nonprofit organizations who are there to help people sign up. That's been put on hold because the system's not working. So hopefully the system starts to work, that outreach and part that's not really dependent on a website working, but you do need the IT system working, but needs to have can start to really gin up the signing up for health insurance, and then we'll get past it, and we'll find ourselves in January with this all behind us, and people actually getting access to care. But we have to wait and see.
And Dr. Susan Wood, assuming things get up and running and the focus is now goes back on what the benefits are as opposed to the glitches, will that then will we be able to then focus on what I see as a very gratuitous kind of cruelty that's going on in the country, and I don't quite understand it, where you've got the biggest some billionaires getting subsidized for crop insurance out of the farm bill, at the same time that the Department of Agriculture, that also is in charge of the SNAP program, the food stamps program, the Republicans in Congress are cutting food stamps while subsidizing millionaires and billionaires who have land holdings. Joe Stiglitz, the Nobel laureate, has a piece about it in the New York Times. But on top of that obscenity, you have a similar thing where a lot of Republican governors are refusing to expand Medicaid.
Right.
And it makes no sense. There's no skin off their nose. It's just gratuitous cruelty. So do you think we'll ever get focused on that? Can you shame these people?
Well, I think with the, you know, and for your listeners, the fact that, you know, I think now 26 states are expanding Medicaid. I expect a handful of more will decide to do that within the next few months. But that will still leave probably something around 20 states that at this point have declined to expand access to Medicaid for those folks who make up to 138% of poverty. And the reason, as you said, that sort of makes no sense, it makes no sense in a couple of different ways. First of all, anyone who joins Medicaid is part of that expansion to get health insurance through Medicaid, or in some states having the Medicaid system pay for their health insurance premiums, that cost is to be borne 100% by the federal government and ultimately 90% by the federal government. And that's as compared to some states now have to pay 50 or 60% of the cost for their Medicaid population, their existing Medicaid population. And so this is just saying we won't take that 100% or 90% of the cost to help these uninsured folks who are still having to go to emergency rooms or ending up with very poor health outcomes because of lack of health care. They're going to show up at our emergency rooms and we'll have to pay for them somehow, but now we're turning away this money from the federal government to actually cover them so they can get the health care they need and not show up in our emergency rooms. So that's one reason why it makes no sense. And of course, the other reason is that the way the Affordable Care Act, the health law was written, was with the assumption that states would do that. And so,
did we lose the call? It looks as if we did. Okay, well, we're going to call back Dr. Susan Wood, the former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health and a professor of health policy and environmental and occupational health, and the executive director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. So hopefully we've only got a couple of minutes left here in any case, but we wanted to obviously have Susan finish up her comments here. As we close out today's program, and we were just talking then about the Republican governors around the country who are gratuitously cruel in denying health coverage for the least among us who need it, and it doesn't cost them anything. And if they don't do it, they end up paying, you know, through the use of emergency care. So, again, it makes no sense. So I'm hoping we can get Susan. Do we have a problem here with the phones again? Let us hope that we can get her back for in the last minute here. And otherwise, we will. Susan, sorry. Just go ahead and finish your last
thought. My apologies.
Go ahead and finish up your thought there about you know, how it's, you know, this the cutting off Medicaid for in these 20 states. You they end up paying for it at any rate through the emergency care system. You know.
Exactly, and the other point was that those folks left out in the cold really have no other opportunities to get health care. And I think what we're going to see going forward, though, is that states will come to their senses. It may not happen right away, but we did see this earlier with the child health insurance program that the states first did not want to join, not all of them, but within a few years, all 50 states have joined the child health insurance program because both their hospital systems, their doctors, and advocates for kids found that completely unacceptable. And I think we'll see that already, that hospitals who want to be able to have reimbursement for their services, doctors, other health care providers, and those advocates for low-income folks will not allow this to stand in all around the country.
And, of course, it probably wouldn't have the traction it has had these problems not happened with the launch of healthcare.gov. So I get, everything is tied together, right? That if this thing has to succeed in order to get the confidence back, and then to be in a position where these governors will be shamed into doing the right thing.
Right. I mean, assuming we get back on track with the exchanges within the next, you know, over the next, you know, the open enrollment period, which goes to the end of March, or if that's extended a few more months, I would expect then, you know, each year more states would join the expansion of Medicaid in order, again, either through some of them, like Arkansas, have decided to use the exchanges as the way to bring that Medicaid population in, expanded population in, and others are sticking with just expanding traditional Medicaid. But I think, you know, each year more states will join, but you're right, the more successful the exchanges and the fact that people begin to recognize the benefits, the faster those states will want to come on board.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Susan Wood. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She's Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute for Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.